This is My Kind of Weird, a podcast where two people swap and pitch three kinds of media: something watchable, something readable, and something listenable. To see if each other says at the end of the pod, that's My Kind of Weird. I'm your host, Anthony Pollock, and joining me today is horror podcaster Michael Verratti, who some of you may know from the horror podcast Dead for Filth, and he's also a screenwriter. Michael, are you ready to get weird with me?
I cannot wait to get weird with you.
So, Michael, please present your something watchable.
For something watchable, I chose Dario Argento's opera.
You are invited to enjoy an evening of terror.
I am a longtime fan of Dario Argento, and people who know me personally know that it's a dangerous subject to get me started on his filmography, because I've always really appreciated just sort of his stylistic approach to fright. And so frequently people go towards the kind of tent poles in his oeuvre, like Suspiria or Deep Red. And it's not that opera is unknown, I just don't see it discussed as frequently as those two. And I really quite love this movie, for as bananas as it is. It has all the strengths of a giallo, and I will even admit it has some of the failings of giallo as well. But there's just something opulent about it, and we don't get a lot of opulent horror movies these days. It's just really lush and big. I mean, no spoilers for anybody, but there are a number of sequences that take place in opera while it's going on. So the full opera house is packed with an audience. And, you know, you see not only the horror set pieces that Argento is known for, which include some very extravagant kills, including the very famous violent needles taped to the eyelids sequence that has been kind of co-opted in a lot of imagery. Those in themselves are sort of like extravagant pieces. But then he basically built an opera version of Macbeth that is specific to this movie that then a whole audience sits and watches. And I just can't imagine a studio just kind of allowing that today. I mean, where everything is sort of controlled and streamlined, and like, think of the budget, think of the accessibility, think of, you know, the people who don't want to get so weird. And this movie eschews all of that. And I kind of dig that.
I kind of feel like back then, Dario Argento got to that point where almost anything he wanted to make was allowable somehow. I don't know how, but maybe. I mean, I don't really know what the landscape of Italian horror was like, you know, way back then in terms of, Italian horror peers. But maybe it was because he was the great sort of Italian archetype when it comes to horror films. So you feel like you can't believe this was made. I still sort of feel like that about Suspiria, with its very sort of dreamscapey imagery and things like that. So it's interesting that you feel that way. Are there any moments in this film that specifically sort of capture why you enjoy it so much?
Well, I really just, from frame one all the way through the end, I just really appreciate how evocative the atmosphere of this movie is. It's so interesting to me that later in his career, he did an adaptation of Phantom of the Opera, because in a way, I feel like this is the giallo answer to Phantom of the Opera. You know, you have the rising opera star who sort of gets placed due to unfortunate circumstances, and there's somebody, mysterious figure, creeping around doing people in terrible ways. And what I think is really fascinating is how in this world of high art and kind of highbrow consideration, all of this stuff that would be considered by the mainstream to be lowbrow is going on. And I think that's very deliberate on Argento's part, because, you know, for as rich and lush and artistic as his movies are, we know sort of the mainstream's reaction to horror films is often dismissive, to treat it as if it is lowbrow content. And he sort of made a name for himself by creating these art set pieces. You mentioned Suspiria and that sort of beginning sequence with just like the production design and that dance academy and all of the things and time that went into it for then a mainstream film going audience to be dismissive of that kind of piece because it is genre. I kind of feel like opera is a statement to that. He's like, okay, well, you want me to do highbrow. Well, here's what happens when Dario Argento goes into the world of what you consider to be ivory tower art, you know, and I love that. And I think that there's just some really, really wonderful moments in this and really great moments of dread. I think the sequence where our lead character goes to speak to the costume designer and the killer stalks her with the pair of scissors while that's all going on, I think is very, very insane. And like it gets me still to this day. And I've seen this movie many times. And I also think there's a brilliant set piece where the recently passed Daria Nicolotta looks through a eye hole and the killer does something quite untoward that of course leads to bloodshed. And I still think about that whenever I have to look out the eye hole of a door. So I think this movie is very like impactful.
I mean, it's the first time I've ever met anyone who, you know, they get knock at the door. Oh, let's look through the eye hole of that door. It's very last century, Michael. So my something watchable is a film called Spiral.
I think I saw something. There's something not right about this place.
What are you talking about?
There was a couple that were killed 10 years ago.
They knew, and they didn't say anything.
You need to stop thinking that everyone's trying to get you all the time.
Marshall and Tiffany are good people.
Well, to new
neighbors. People can stream by going to Shudder. Now, I went into this film not... I didn't really have any expectations. I didn't have any expectations beyond the sort of the press release that Shudder sent me and the fact that it's a queer horror film.
Right.
So there's a couple of things I like about this film, which goes to my pitch of why people should check this film out. Firstly, it's Jeffrey Boyer Chapman's portrayal of Malik. I'm a big fan of him. I don't know, Michael, if you checked out this series called Unreal. It's basically sort of the real-life story of The Bachelor. It was actually written by The Bachelor's, I think, showrunner or writer or producer or something along those lines. So I really enjoyed his character. Was quite bitchy, which I kind of, but not in a negative light, just kind of very, very sort of outward spoken in terms of how he feels like certain cast people should be treated. So when I saw that he was in this film, I was really excited to see it. It's about a gay couple that move to what is considered, country America, if you will.
Yeah.
It's in a town where they're not used to same-sex couples because this entire film is set in the 90s. And then Jeffrey Boyer Chapman's character, sort of witnesses what appears to be a sort of ritual, and then this old man who sort of approaches him just before the ritual, he ends up dying a couple of days later. So the other reason I like this film is it's an interesting commentary on the sort of, I guess, the accepted homophobia that was running rampant in the 90s for sure, which I guess because of, you know, shows like Friends and things like that, that sort of were, if you look back at them now, they're very homophobic. They're very, they kind of normalize that homophobia. And I feel like this movie, while it's a horror film, it sort of captures how I imagine how gay people would feel when, I guess, surrounded by straight people who aren't accepting of who they are, of who they are as people. So that's sort of my main pitch for that. It's I think it's It's interesting in terms of how it approaches things. It's almost Get Out-ish, but from a queer perspective.
Right. I think that this is a fine example of queer horror because of all the reasons you're saying. I mean, because when you use that phrase queer horror, obviously there are horror movies with queer people in them. And then there are movies that are queer horror because they apply in some way to the queer experience. And I think this movie really, really approaches that idea of being othered in your community and feeling like you are an outsider, and something that's very, very real for a lot of people in the LGBTQIA plus community, growing up in small towns, growing up during times where it was not widely accepted. And that's very real still to this day in a lot of places. And Jeffrey Boyer Chapman's character's increasing paranoia in this, I think, was handled really well in a horror way, but also handled really well in a real way, because I think that is something that a lot of people can relate to.
I found it also quite shocking. I'm not going to spoil what actually happens later on. There is a death that happens close to his character, and his character, Malik, is at the end of it all says to Marshall, who is Lachlan Munro's character, and Lachlan Munro is sort of that character actor that always plays the that sort of character where they're always up to something. You don't know what, but they're always up to something. And he's just like, "Why are you doing this to me?" And the response is, "We do this to you because you're different and no one will miss you." And I'm just like, holy shit. That is a uncomfortable realization and, I guess, truth about how people, I guess, who have differences as a whole are treated by, you know, sort of the people with nuclear family values.
Well, in setting this movie in the 90s was certainly no mistake. I mean, even though those attitudes are still prevalent in parts of the world still today, I definitely see sort of what they were doing just historically speaking with what was going on with the queer community at the time, because at that point in the 90s, we're coming right off of the AIDS crisis. And quite literally in the U.S., it was sort of marked upon by our government at the time that there was inaction because the air quotes right kind of people weren't dying. And that's literally what's being said here. Nobody will pay attention because you're not the right kind of person that's dying, so we can get away with this. And so I think that that's a very, very clear cultural and historical parallel that's being drawn in this moment.
Yeah, I feel like the biggest unfortunate about this film isn't the film itself. It's the fact that a film of a very similar name is about to come out, and because it's related to Saw, I have a fear it's going to bury this film, which I feel like is really unfortunate in terms of, because it's two of the same names, that people aren't going to discover this film as much as they probably should if they haven't already. And I feel like that's a disappointing thing.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think especially because we still don't see as much queer representation on screen in genre films as I think that we need. Every single release that's out there that's doing serviceable stories needs to be found, because there are people out there who need it. But I just think this is like one of those circumstances where you know, the industry is its own nebulous beast sometimes. And a lot of times you don't even get control over what your movie ends up getting titled. I'm sure the nine movies that like came out that were titled La Llorona would agree, you know?
certainly not shitting on the Saw movie called Spiral that's about to come out, but yeah, it's just unfortunate circumstance.
No, I'm excited about that movie too. I agree with you. It has nothing to do with the movies in question. It's just more to do with the confusion of titles.
Totally. All right, Michael, present your something readable.
Something readable, I chose a graphic novel called Dracula Motherfucker that was done by Alex DeCampi, and I'm going to grab it here just to make sure that I say the last names right.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it was Alex DeCampi and Erica Henderson. Mm. And I picked this because people who listen to Dead for Filth know, but I don't often get to a chance to talk about, I love comic books and I love graphic novels. And so infrequently do I get a chance to kind of shout from the rooftops a title that is kind of lighting me up. And I'm a big Dracula fan. And this particular book is a short story that takes place in the 1970s. And it is based on the supposition that Dracula's brides had kind of had enough of his shenanigans. And
his bullshit, if you will.
Yeah, definitely. And they trapped him in his coffin, and they've been living kind of their fabulous, like, disco lives throughout the 70s. And some failing actress in Hollywood revives Dracula with the hopes that his power will imbue her with, like, her own kind of new fame and revitalize her career and all of this. And this poor... This poor photographer who gets caught in the in-between. It's kind of a very short and sweet graphic novel, and it's illustrated in a very pulpy sort of fashion. So I think it hits like a lot of marks and checks a lot of boxes, depending what kind of horror you're into. If you like a good old-fashioned EC Comics, it's got that look, it's got that feel. So it's got sort of that kind of classic aesthetic, but also it's got a bit of exploitation cinema in there because it's set during like the gritty 1970s Los Angeles. But there's also like a little bit of sexy European intrigue, what with the Brides of Dracula. And then it kind of gets weirdly metaphysical and almost like heavy metal magazine with this like spiraling colors and how they represent. Yeah. And how they represent Dracula himself is not so much as like a Christopher Lee or a Bela Lugosi, but more so this sort of like dark spiraling cloud of fangs and eyes. I love that because culturally, the idea of Dracula is just so big at this point. The idea that like it's so monolithic. How do you represent that and still make it scary to people? Well, then you merely just represent it sort of as a non-corporeal idea. And I love everything that's going on here. And I'm speaking as someone who tends to like a lot more structure and setup to the stories I read. I sort of love that this just jumps into it, gets hella weird, gets hella crazy, and then taps the bell out. I was just like, I feel totally satisfied. And if you really dig Dracula or vampire stories set in the 70s, like Dracula 80, 1972, or Blackula, this, I think, will really please you.
Yeah, especially since I wasn't even going to talk about this, but just that last comment you've made is there's sort of, with Dracula stories, there's kind of, there's Dracula in the 1800s or the early 1900s, and then there's this huge jump, and then suddenly we're in the 80s or 90s. It's very rare that you see something Dracula-ish in the sort of the 70s, and it's very rare that you sure, even if you do, that it celebrates that era to its fullest extent. I definitely agree with the way and how Dracula is portrayed. It's almost sort of like a... It's kind of... You know how Dracula has been portrayed in the past in terms of... Being suddenly Bram Stoker's Dracula in terms of how he can he has the ability to, I guess, transmogrify into different types of beasts and animals and things like that. It's almost like that, except it's more like the Dracula that is portrayed here is more like a almost like darkness itself, like a I don't know, a shadow, if you will, that can kind of envelop the character that he's trying to basically prey on. So that was interesting. And I found the sort of revenge paradigm really fulfilling at the end, to be honest with you. And I kind of, you feel sorry for, I can't remember the character's name, but the guy who was at the centerpiece who acts as the audience surrogate to all the what the fuckery he's experiencing. He ends up as sort of the plaything for Dracula's hot ex-wives. I kind of, up until that point, I felt really sorry for him. It's just kind of like, oh, okay, he's going to live forever and he's got that. Okay. If only.
But, you know, what's interesting about that character, too, his name is the character's name is Quincy Harker. And of course, that's not a mistake because it's Jonathan Harker, of course, is the man who goes to Transylvania at the beginning of Bram Stoker's novel.
And
brings him back. And then if you recall, and later in Dracula, when Van Helsing kind of puts together the posse of vampire hunters, which, you know, depending which version of the story you are seeing translated to screen or whatever, they tend to leave a lot of them out. But in other one of the group is a Texan named Quincy Morris. So I think that the this person is probably inferred to be a relative of either Quincy Morris or Jonathan Harker, descended down to swinging 1970s LA.
I saw a bit of pulp influences there in Erica. Is it Henderson? Is that it? I kind of felt it was a bit blaxploitation influences in there as well, kind of like a melding of the two in terms of the colors, like the coloration definitely. And yeah, did you get that? Or?
Oh, absolutely. I think so. I mean, that's why, you know, at the end I referenced Blackula, because I think that on all of these sort of 70s references, and you hit the nail on the head with the kind of color palette of this book. It is very clearly evoking a time and a style of film. If this movie Dracula, if this graphic novel Dracula Motherfucker was a movie, it would not be like at the multiplex. It would be playing like at a 42nd Street theater or a grindhouse movie theater. And I don't think we would want it any other way.
Yeah. It's a bit of a allegory for how Black people would have felt back in those days in terms of Quincy's trying to get because he's a paparazzi trying to get dead people and corpses, I guess you could say. He's trying to get that next big score so that he can, you know, pay his bills for the next couple of months. And every time he thinks he's got some great big opportunity, he's kind of like, or they'll pay me like a couple hundred dollars, and which, you know, back then is a lot of money. And it's just, and the editor is like, we'll give you $25, kid. So, take it or leave it. And then to him being pursued, feeling like trapped, cornered in, if you will, the various forces beyond his control manipulating his life and his struggle are there as well.
Well, and you know what I think is really interesting, and you know, while I don't personally want to speak for the Black experience, what I do think is really interesting about the construction of this novel and how Quincy's story runs parallel to the Brides is like the Brides literally turn against Dracula because he is trying to dictate everything about their lives, where they have no autonomy of their own and wants to make them reliant on him. And it's sort of like a smash the patriarchy moment. They're like, no, we're rising up and taking back. And then we see that at the beginning. And then as we watch how the patriarchy treats Quincy until they come into his life as well, because every time he tries to get a foot ahead, he gets pushed backwards. And it's sort of like what I do really think is fascinating is how it highlights power struggles and how, much like in the discussion of Spiral, it's all about how those who are in control of the world can quite easily ignore those who are not. And I think that's really fascinating.
What's even more fascinating is you chose this book and I chose that movie.
Yeah.
All right. So my something readable is a little novella, which a lot of people have come to know as a movie, but we'll talk about the novella because it's my podcast. The Mist by one Stephen King. And if you haven't heard of Stephen King, go to Wikipedia. For me, I read The Mist as a short story in a collection of Stephen King short stories. I believe you can still get it somewhere. I can't remember what the collection is called. But that said, it was one of the stories in here. I found it really, I mean, you know, I'd read all sorts of Stephen King by that point. I was 15 and kind of, you know, early 2000s, just kind of getting into anything horror related. So at that point, I'd read Pet Sematary. I'd read sort of the Darker Half and all those sorts of things. But when it came to this short story, I found it really inspiring how I believe it only went for about 30 or 40 pages, created this very visceral world located in, you know, a shopping center of all places where everything was going wrong. You've got, you know, people and end of the world, conspiracy theorists. You've got people who are trapped in this shopping center while the outside is killing anyone who goes out there. So people, you know, religious nuts are propping up in the group. And it's a very sort of telling short story of, I guess, the human experience as a whole in terms of how bad humans can get. It's almost a commentary on, I guess, when push comes to shove, the true nature of someone can come out and how they react to being under pressure and under stress is definitely revealed in this book. There's also a sex scene in the refrigerator, so you know, which didn't make it to the film as we all know. But I found it an interesting read. Have you ever read it, Michael?
I have. I'm a huge Stephen King fan, and I kind of similarly to you, when I discovered his works, I burned through them quite quickly early on and then started to kind of parse them out over the course of my life. But I remember really digging this story because of that sort of Twilight Zone feel of it. You know, the idea that the monster is outside, but the real monsters are in here, and those are the people. And I think the movie, of course, gets a lot of things right about how this is constructed, because I know exactly the sort of supermarket that Stephen King describes in the story. I grew up in rural America. I probably went to the very kind of supermarket he described. And yes, it would be a hellish nightmare to be trapped in those just with like other people, let alone with monsters outside. But I think it's a brilliant story about paranoia and what you said. It's really about kind of the human condition and the not nice parts of it.
Yeah, and I feel we're kind of talking about the movie now anyway, so we might as well continue. I found that all the sort of the innuendo that King put into the novella the screenwriters expertly managed to capture in the film, such as the not being able to see what's actually in the mist, the discussion around how there had been army men that had come through the town earlier that week. You actually have an army guy in the film. So I feel like if you leave enough, narrative, like even just basic narrative around things that can be explored when it's adapted to film, and for that film for you to actually be seeing something in the flesh of what you read all those years ago or even just earlier that day, then it's very telling of just how good that story is.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't purposely mean to bring up the film, but it's just funny because I remember reading this novella, and it was so impactful. It left a quite a mark because of just how stark King describes it. That later, when I saw the film, because you know how it is. Sometimes you read a book, and then like years later, they make a movie, and you're like, "Oh, I should go see that because I read the book," and you kind of remember, and it's like satisfying and of that, but like, it's exactly like you said. It took me right back to reading it, and that's a rare experience. Even knowing the differences, and there are differences.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, and yeah, it's I'm trying to talk about this without referencing The Fog, and it's really hard not to. tell me about your something listenable, Michael.
Okay. Well, something listenable. I must confess that when I sent this to you, I actually had a moment where I was like, wait, was I supposed to send him a song or a whole album? And I think I just mentioned the song. And the song I picked was Zombina and the Skeletons, Nobody Likes You When You're Dead. The album it comes from is Taste the Blood of Zombina and the Skeletons. And I recommend people listen to both. And if you're not familiar with Zombina and the Skeletons, they are sort of a pop punk horror band who really relies heavily on the music of, or like just kind of horror movie references and drive-in kind of era horror movies. And Nobody Likes You When You're Dead is a song about a girl who kind of realizes that no one paid attention to her till she was dead. And she was a beauty queen and now she's not, but now she's getting more attention than before. It's very dark and very bizarre, but it's also kind of like an up-tempo number. I've always wanted to use it to open a film. Zombina, I know you're listening. Please give me those rights. But no, I've just always really, really liked this band and I've always really liked this song and I really liked this album. And for some reason, even amongst horror fans who'd like a little bit of crossover and horror punk, they don't seem to be as known in certain circles. They're from Liverpool, mm-hmm. England. I discovered them when I was doing a lot of stuff on the horror convention circuit. And I think they're great. I'm a huge fan.
Yeah, I was actually surprised that I hadn't heard of them before. When you first sent them to me, I'm just like, oh, yeah, I've heard of them before. But when I listen to them, I'm just like, actually, I haven't. I've never heard this band. And how have I never heard this band? I love the – it's very fun. It's very punk rock, sort of very, I would say, 80s punk rock. But it's very much has an underground aesthetic to the group. I listened to about 10 songs of theirs on YouTube. Are they big or within I guess their fan base or
See, the funny thing is I always thought so, or maybe I was just running around with like some hardcore Zombina fans because when I discovered them was through a friend of mine who I used to work at a horror movie magazine with. And she was super into it, and she would travel around and go to, like, you know, a lot of basement shows and underground shows and punk shows, and I was doing a lot of the same. And she introduced me to them, and I got really into their work. And the Taste the Blood of Zombina and the Skeletons album actually features artwork from a man named Art Baltazar, and Art Baltazar has gone on to be a DC Comics artist. And I've met him a number of times when I've been doing speaking events at Comic-Con. I've talked to him about Zombina. And so, like, I guess just like in my brain and like in the world that I walk among, Zombina is a thing. But then I have like been in instances like this where I'm talking about horror punk or horror rock or metal or whatever. And I'm like, oh yeah, like Zombina and the Skeletons. And people are like, what are you talking about? So, are they big? Maybe. And it's like not one of those things where I was like, I was into that band before anybody knew it. No, like, I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that, like, I've been a fan for a while and I just thought that people were, and I assume people are. So,
because I listened to that song you sent me to check out, and when I found a video of it on YouTube, it only had 4,000 views, and I'm just kind of like, this doesn't sound right. Hey, it might be one of those, you know, the punk rock aesthetic and the fan base, especially underground punk rock, has this thing where not all of them will necessarily listen to stuff online, you know? So,
Well, it's interesting. it's interesting too, because you mentioned the punk rock aesthetic, and I don't know if you've noticed this, but there are horror fans who, like, when their horror love goes over to music, it's like horror metal only or horror punk only. So I think that, like, it further divides into these small sub pockets that
Sub genres. Well, this kind of relates. My Something Listenable is an album by Wednesday 13, which is called Transylvania 90210, / Songs of Death, Dying, and the Dead. It's staring back at me. It started to breathe and then it started to bleed. The moon cracked open and it started to flow. Was exposed. The gods gave me my own TV show, and they called it Transylvania. Now, that said, this is far from a depressive album. I actually think it's a lot of fun. It's great for anyone who's into that sort of horror punk subgenre. It has a bit of heavy metal and goth metal influences thrown in the mix as well. For those who aren't familiar with Wednesday 13, Wednesday, the singer / guitarist who writes all the music, he was in a band called The Murder Dolls, which had members of Static X and Slipknot in it. At one point, he also used to, when he first started, he was the singer of a band called Frankenstein Drag Queens from Planet 13. So if that doesn't give you enough to let you figure out on your own that the band is about horror, I don't know what else to say. other than it's a great fun album. It has lots of great sort of the lyrics are very horror centric. The Wednesday has gone on record saying before that he's very much into sort of your 80s and 90s and sort of very much horror from back in sort of like your Hammer House of Horror days and those sorts of things. So from the 40s, 50s, 60s. And before, so you'll get lots of great references in this album. I think the best reference that and most recognizable one you'll find on the song Post-Mortem Boredom, which is a fun title. It references Last House on the Left, with swapping the advertising campaign from it's only a movie to it's only a recording. So, there's lots of fun things like that. If you're into Poison, they throw in the look what the bats dragged in, which is instead of look what the cats dragged in. So it's lots of great fun. What did you think of the album, Michael?
I quite enjoyed this album. I really, especially because I knew that we were also going to be talking about Zombina. I was like, wow, what great synergy, because both of these bands in their way really pay homage to horror movies of a specific era. I mean, to look even at the track listing of this album, there's a song called I Walked with a Zombie, or like The House by the Cemetery. And that's great. Or, The Ghost of Vincent Price. And the title track, I actually really, really enjoyed the Transylvania 90210 song itself, which I want to point out for people who don't know, there was a period of time where Elvira wrote a couple like young adult novels with John Paragon.
Yeah.
And one of the books was called Transylvania 90210.
Hey, with all the homages on this album, it wouldn't even surprise me if there's even some kind of really even some weak connection to it. So yeah, that would not surprise me at all.
No, I love it. You can tell that Wednesday 19 loves horror movies, and really, and this is like everything. This album is all about. So I was into it. I had a good time. And in fact, I listened to it a couple times. I listened to it when you first sent it. And then in preparation for our sit down, while I was just kind of getting ready and setting up my microphone and things, I was playing it again. So it's kind of like a cool jazz up for a podcast album.
Yeah, it used to be one of those albums that I think it was about When did it come out? 2005. So I would have been 20. Jeez, that's a scary thought. It was one of those albums I listened to as about to go out clubbing or go out for a drink. I just feel like it's got this really sort of party vibe to it.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I must confess, I knew about Wednesday 13, but I had not listened to this album, and I appreciate that you introduced me to it.
Great. Now, let's do the verdicts. So, Michael, were any of my picks your kind of weird?
I mean, I enjoyed all three of the things that you picked, but if any would rise above for me, it's going to be The Mist, because I can never get enough Stephen King, and I think this is Stephen King firing on all cylinders. I think that he is truly a master of a great short story that kind of leaves you wondering, and this is a prime example. Forget the movie, forget the TV series, although both are really, you know, worth a look. This takes it back to basics. It's true human paranoia. It is that kind of slice of Americana that he's so good at. It's kind of calling the human condition into question. And I dig that. And I think that you look at something like Spiral and how Spiral works on calling the human condition into question and paranoia. And it's sort of like, oh, there is not really an arena of horror that was not influenced by Stephen King's touch a little bit. And I love that. So The Mist is definitely my kind of weird. These are all my kind of weird, but that's the crown of the weirdness for me.
Jewel. Not to say that all of his short stories are good. We'll have to talk about Stephen King's Tiger another time. that was a thing. Michael, do you have something you want to ask me?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to know of the ones that I introduced to you, I'm just going to reverse the question, because I think the whole point is, did either of us take something new away? What did you dig or not dig about the things I brought to you?
I was not aware of opera, so being transparent here, I didn't get a chance to watch opera, because I couldn't find it. The Tubi, you said to me, watched on Tubi, and it just wasn't there. Maybe the Aussie Tubi content is different, which, you know, streamers, they tend to do that. But I really enjoyed your pitch around it, so that in itself is my kind of weird. As for, I mean, I really dug Zombino, was it?
Yeah,
it's Zombino. And the Skeletons, yeah, I really dug that. I think I'm going to try and listen on Spotify next time and actually listen to an entire album from start to finish. I feel like I just got a smattering of different songs of theirs from different albums, so it'd be good to really get into that. And I found it quite annoying that you introduced me to a graphic novel and I run a comic book website which reports on news and we put reviews up. We have about 5,000 to 10,000 readers every month, and I had not heard of Dracula Motherfucker, so that was lots of fun. So that was definitely my kind of weird.
Yay. I just stumbled on that one because I am a big Dracula nerd. It's upsetting probably to some people. Like, there's Dracula all over my place. So anytime there's some new Dracula misadventure, I always have to know. Plus, I love some comic books, so
it's always the way to be. So we're going to go on a quick sponsor break, and when we come back, Michael and I are going to have a quick chat.
A little culture for you there. Hello, everyone. Or good day, as your hosts might say. Producer Andy here. I edit and tinker with this podcast to make it sound lovely and smooth and soft. Just like me. I remove the ums and the pauses and the little bumps and whines and groans and the near constant sound of Anthony snorting coke. If you are listening to this podcast, and you are, then you might be interested in things like comics. I'm not. I think they're for children. But if you are, Then why not head on over to sodaandtelepaths.com, the sister site to this podcast. At sodaandtelepaths.com, you will find all the latest on comics, science fiction, and horror. And there are many, many interviews with writers and other people who've never had a real job. So head on over to sodaandtelepaths.com and make me proud of you. Don't let me down.
So, Michael, you've obviously done a bit of screenwriting. You run a horror podcast. For those of you who aren't familiar with you and I guess what you've done previously, could you like to give them a bit of an idea?
Yeah, I first and foremost am a screenwriter. I have worked quite primarily in the horror genre, and I've written a number of independent horror films. But I also do a lot of television here in the U.S. I've written a lot of television thrillers as well as holiday movies. I do occasionally step outside of the genre for a little family fun. And I've done Christmas movies and thrillers, and I do a fair bit of directing these days as well. I have directed a handful of queer horror shorts, including one that played pretty much around the world called The Office Is Mine. It played at Mardi Gras in Australia, actually, as well as a Halloween slasher short called Halloween Trick. A lot of people who know my directing and writing work know that I work on a show called The Boulay Brothers Dracula, which is a show that is sort of like the intersection of horror identity and drag. And it is we seek to find the world's next super monster. And I started working on the show in season 3. I was a writer and a director for the show, as well as one of the guest judges. I wrote and created I created and curated Dead for Filth, which is a show that I hosted all about the intersection of queer identity and horror, where for 100 episodes, I talked to different queer horror creators and actors and performers and allies. I also do a lot of live talks and writing on queer horror out in the world. So I'm a little bit of everywhere all at once. That's kind of what I do in a very jumbled nutshell.
Now, you run the podcast called Dead for Filth. I'm kind of going to steal something from that podcast for my next question. Why horror?
The question. Why horror? Well, I can answer that in two ways. For me personally, it's because horror, it is ultimately the most powerful of genres, I think. When horror is done correctly, it really can do things that no other genre can. And by that, I mean, it's by definition a genre of the subversive, where you can use this dark lens of the fantastic to address things that otherwise in the mainstream we may not be quite ready to deal with. You can disguise it as a monster. You can disguise it as an allegory. And in doing so, face your fears and get catharsis out of it. And I think there's something really powerful and exciting about that. And all throughout history, we've watched as horror has done that. During the time that Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, the debate of God versus science was raging, across the Western world. And she literally wrote a movie about what happens when man plays God using science. Godzilla is born in the aftermath of the dropping of the atomic weapon. During the Middle Eastern conflicts, during the Bush administration, we see a rise in torture porn, to use the phrase, movies like Saw and Hostel. Horror has always been the mirror of society. And when people, when I was talking about opera, how people tend to like to think of it as lowbrow, I always say no. Not if you're really paying attention. Horror is actually often the truth. It may just be a truth that you don't want to look at. And for me personally, when I was growing up, I was originally sort of a scaredy cat. I didn't like anything that seemed too spooky. I would run and turn off the TV if the music got too intense, too much to the chagrin of my parents. And then one night I saw that they were playing a double feature of Attack of the Killer Tomatoes and Return of the Killer Tomatoes on a show called USA Up All Night, which was a hosted kind of creature feature double show that they would show on Friday and Saturday nights at the in the late 80s and the early 90s. And I was just kind of obsessed with the idea of killer tomatoes. What is that? But then I made my mom let me stay up, and she was very, you know, sweet about it. And I watched both of those movies, and it was sort of like this weird baptism by strangeness, because by morning, everything was different for me because I realized that these movies were not like the movies that they were playing at the movie theater. They were not like the movies my friends were talking about at school. And that kind of really lit a fire under my ass, because I was just like, wait, there's a whole other kind of movie out there that feels strange and that feels forbidden, and I want to know about it. And so I then kind of set out and spent the rest of my life looking for those weirdo movies, and they've kind of become my world.
So let's talk about those weirdo films. So for me, there's been some really odd horror films that have come out, you know, in the last couple of decades. What is the strangest horror film that you have seen of late? Doesn't have to be a brand new horror film. And why do you think people should check it out?
The strangest horror film I've seen of late, I actually just watched a horror film from 1986 called The Seventh Curse that is, I believe, a Hong Kong horror film starring Chow Yun-fat. And it was on Midnight Pulp, which is sort of a horror streaming service. I don't know where globally it's available, but they sort of curate the kind of more transgressive horror movies, or like in a lot of foreign films. And someone had just mentioned the title to me, and they said, this movie's outrageous, and you're not going to believe. And they were like, you're not going to believe it. And I'm at this point sort of very seasoned in the way that I'm like, uh-huh, sure, whatever. And then I watched it, and it was outrageous, and I couldn't believe it. It was just, I don't even know how to describe this film other than, the lead character is in the jungle and runs across like this satanic cult, or this like devil worshiping cult. And he gets a blood curse placed upon him, where every so often, like one of his veins just pops, he has this like eruption on his skin. And when the seventh vein erupts, then he'll drop dead. So he and his like gang of misfits head back into see if they can reverse the curse, if you will, before his like final vein explodes. And it's as gory and nonsense as it sounds. It's like a little bit of Evil Dead meets Peter Jackson's Dead Alive, Brain Dead, and all through this kind of like Hong Kong lens, because of course there's like high flying martial arts and stuff, but then all of a sudden, like there's a weird practical effect where a skeleton is just chomping at someone's face while his veins are popping out and oozing all over the place. I was just like, what is this movie? Why do I love it? And how come I've never seen it before? So that, and I just watched it last week. So the fact that I'm still discovering things is really proof that there's so much out there. There's a world of movies out there to find.
It can't be anywhere near as bad as Black Sheep.
I love Black Sheep. What a good pick.
there's a lot of strange horror films out there that involves animals. I think there's another one called, I saw it years ago. I might get the name wrong, but I think it's called Poultry of the Damned or something like that.
Oh, no. Just, Poultrygeist, chicken of the chicken.
Yeah. Oh dear.
I was going to say, here's a little bit of trivia for you about Poultrygeist, because not only is it a movie not a lot of people have heard of, but, and this is a staggering bit of information, a few years ago, probably a decade ago now, MSN did a list of the top 10 civil rights horror films, and Poultrygeist is on that list because it's one of the only movies to ever address animal rights. And that's, it's so like this bizarre deep cut movie about living chicken nuggets attacking people. Like it's, but recognized by MSN, you know?
Oh dear. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. I've kind of got this image in my head of, you know, walking into the PETA headquarters and they got that film on constant repeat. switching gears for a bit, like you're touching on with horror, and I feel like science fiction is like this a bit as well, is that you can address issues within a society without necessarily addressing the issues in society. You can use things metaphorically, you can use them as allegories, whatever you want to call it. Do you feel that with sort of the rise of more, queer horror films, that the right stories are being told now, or do you feel like that's still a step in the creating queer horror films that has been skipped?
Well, the answer is yes and no. It's a tricky question, right? Because I think that we're at a place where even 10 years ago, a movie like Spiral getting financed, let alone being made available on a major streaming platform that is owned by AMC, which is a big network, would not have been likely. And so, you know, you've got movies like Spiral or Rift or Midnight Kiss, which Blumhouse did for Hulu. Those all feel, you know, those all are starting to take a step into the queer horror space. And there have been queer horror films before those, as well. And what happens is, like, now the visibility is just getting bigger and we're getting bigger and bigger platforms releasing them. But does that mean then that there's not a lot of work to be done? No, absolutely not. There's still a lot of work to be done. Because one story, one movie truly can't represent everybody in a community. I mean, when you look at the acronym of LGBTQIA, that's a lot of letters, a lot of identifiers that each speak to a very different lived experience. And some people are just barely getting represented, and some people haven't been represented yet at all. And so the work has to continue, that even as we're starting to see, yes, more gay male-driven horror films or more, you know, lesbian-driven horror films, we need trans horror films, and we need bi horror films, and we need non-binary horror films, and some kind of mishmash of all of them, and you know, things that we haven't even touched upon, because it's still a long way to go. But yeah. I think that people are becoming more aware that there's a need. Not that there wasn't always a need, but we just needed the people in the positions of power to pay attention. And I feel like there's been a shift and new people are taking those spots. So hopefully we're in the right direction. But, you know, as with anything, you can't get complacent. You have to keep asking for it. You have to keep fighting for it.
Yeah. Yeah. What would you say is your favorite horror film? Or top three if you can't pick a favorite.
Oh, gosh. You know, it changes. It's sort of like they're all my weirdo life benchmarks, because I can think of different times in my life when a specific horror movie really meant something to me. Or like, so I always have a hard time doing a top 10 list, because I'm like, oh, but then you left this out, or blah, 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 blah. But I think, I mean, I always return to Poltergeist, I think, is a really brilliant film, because Poltergeist shows that you don't have to spill any blood to tell a truly scary story. And I think that it's just a brilliantly made movie. I can't pick an Argento film, as evidenced by my fangirling earlier. I'm a huge fan of his. At any given time, it changes. I've probably seen Phenomena the most of his movies, because it's a movie that when I put it on for people, it's usually like there's this movie where Jennifer Connelly is in the hills of Sweden and she talks to bugs and Donald Pleasance is there with a monkey and there's a serial killer. And people are like, that's made up. And I'm like, it certainly is not. Now we're going to watch it. I love that movie. Night of the Creeps. There's this horror movie called Night of the Creeps that Fred Decker directed, which has always been one of my favorite horror movies. In fact, there is a series of books called My Favorite Horror Movie. I think there are three volumes. And the editor of that, Christian Ackerman, reached out to different people within the genre, filmmakers and writers and whatnot, and asked everybody to write an essay about their favorite horror movies. And mine was on Night of the Creeps, and it opens the second volume. So if I don't say that, then someone out there is going to be like, well, he wrote about it in this book. Why is he not talking about that book? I love that movie a lot. I always say it's like if John Hughes made an alien slug zombie movie, which really should sell it in of itself. So Night of the Creeps, Poltergeist, an oscillating Argento pick. I'm also a huge fan of a movie called Cemetery Man, Della Morte, Della More, if you're in Italy. I really just love it. Usually people kind of can clue in that I love a good atmospheric horror film. The more lush and weird and gothic it is, the more likely you're going to get my attention.
Well, Michael, thanks for letting us get to know you through the lens of this podcast. Where can people find you on your socials?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. It's probably the best place. It's at Michael Verratti. It's just my name. Also the same on Instagram. If you're interested in Dead for Filth, it is at Dead for Filth on Twitter, as well as Dead for Filth wherever podcasts are found. I will say that Dead for Filth at 100 episodes is now currently on hiatus, but there are 100 episodes of Queer Horror Creators that you can go back and discover. The show was structured where it was meant to be kind of timeless interviews. We rarely talked about anything too topical, just so you could preserve the history of each person. I believe she has mentioned it in interviews, so I think I'm now safe to. For people who are waiting for me to return to the world of podcasts, Peaches Christ and I are teaming up for a new podcast that's coming out soon. I'm very excited to be on the airwaves with her because together we cause a lot of trouble. And
that's the best time for relationships.
Exactly. So that's coming. And just keep your eyes and ears open.
All right. That's it for us today. For those of you who haven't subscribed, go check out and subscribe to My Kind of Weird wherever you get your podcast from. And for me, my name's Anthony. My guest has been
Michael Verratti.
And just in the true spirit of horror films, Michael and I know what you did last summer. Thanks for listening, everyone.